But we mustn't forget that there are 12 more links. We mustn't forget that the most important, in the sense of the most comprehensive formulation of conditioned co-production, is a 24-fold one. These 12 positive links, as I personally call them, very often are forgotten. They seem to have been forgotten from very early times. They're mentioned only in two or three places in the Pali canon, the Pali scriptures. And so far as I know, they're not mentioned in the Mahayana scriptures at all. And this is rather unfortunate. We hear a lot about the first set of 12 links, but we hardly ever hear about that second positive set. And this is unfortunate because it helps to give the impression in some quarters that Buddhist spiritual practice is primarily negative, that it consists simply in getting rid of craving, getting rid of clinging, and so on. So it's important not to forget the 12 positive links. And in any case, these represent the spiral type of conditionality. And without them, our picture of reality is represented by the principle of conditionality, is incomplete. Moreover, without them, the path, the spiritual path, has no rationale. So what then are the 12 positive links? Let me enumerate these two very briefly. First of all, suffering. Well, you might think that not very positive, but actually it is. We learn a great deal from suffering. So the spiral starts with suffering. The path starts with suffering, both physical and mental, because in dependence on suffering there arises two, faith. Happiness is not a problem. If you're happy, if you're in a state of bliss, you don't say, well, why am I happy? What's made me happy? Why should I be happy? You don't say that. You're happy to be happy. But if you suffer, you start wondering, why am I suffering? Why should I suffer? Why me? And if you believe in God, well, you start praying to God. God, why are you making me suffer? You blame it all on God. So if you suffer, you start looking for a cause. If you suffer, you realize that the things that are making you suffer aren't things which can give you real happiness. Reality doesn't reside in them. So you start looking for something else. You start looking for something higher, something more satisfactory, something more inspiring, something more sublime. And perhaps your eyes come to rest on the figure of the Buddha, or you become acquainted with the teaching and you feel something, you respond. So in this way, in dependence on suffering, there arises faith. Faith is so important. Faith in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Faith in Buddhism isn't belief. It's not intellectual assent to a particular doctrine or dogma. Broadly speaking, we may say that faith represents the wholehearted emotional response that we experience when we come into contact with something, someone, that represents a higher mode of being, a higher mode of existence, something absolutely beyond. And our whole heart, our whole being goes out towards that. That's faith. So in dependence on suffering, there arises faith. And in dependence on faith, there arises free joy. You're so happy that you found something in which you can have faith, not just belief, but faith, something to which you can respond with your whole being, to which you can commit yourself. You're so happy, you're overcome with joy. So in dependence on faith, there arises joy. And in dependence on joy, because after all we're on the spiral now, there arises rapture. You sing and you dance, perhaps you're carried away. You're mad with it, huh? Like those mad Chan monks, perhaps they'd reached that stage or even gone beyond it. Huh? So independence on joy there arises rapture. But then independence on rapture there arises, well, a word which we can only really translate as serenity. Hmm? The exuberance of rapture dies down. Hmm? The external manifestations, the psychosomatic manifestations of rapture die down. You're just left with a very deep inner rapture, which is so deep it doesn't require outward expression. Yeah? And then that intensifies further. In dependence on serenity, in that sense, there arises bliss. And the Dhammapada says, nirvana is the supreme bliss. So you're on the path of bliss. And then, in dependence on bliss, there arises, as the seventh link, concentration. That's rather interesting. If you experience bliss, you've no problem with concentration. Concentration in this context doesn't mean the forcible fixation of attention. If you reach this stage or this level of bliss, you're spontaneously and naturally concentrated, because if you're as blissful as that, well, who wants to stray away from it? Huh? You'll be senseless. This reminds me of a little incident again in the Buddha's life, showing the interdependence of concentration and bliss. A certain king came to see the Buddha. Came probably with his army, his attendants, his wives, concubines, court physician, and so on. And they got talking. And the king was looking at the Buddha, who was living in this little hut. Because in the Buddha's day, they didn't have magnificent monasteries. Huh? And when you come across the term vihara in translations of Buddhist texts, you mustn't think of a magnificent building. Vihara really means just a lodging. Huh? And it was usually a little mud hut with leaves on the roof. So here was the Buddha staying in his little hut. And the king came to see him. And the king must have thought that the Buddha was having a pretty miserable time. Because the king said, I think I'm more happy than you. The Buddha said, no. I think I'm more happy than you. And the king said, no, it's impossible. You've got nothing, I've got everything. I'm the more happy. Buddha said, no. The king said, prove it. The Buddha said, can you sit still, enjoying perfect happiness and bliss for a week? King said, no. Buddha said, can you sit still, perfectly still, enjoying complete bliss for a day? King said, no. And the Buddha said, can you sit still, enjoying complete bliss for an hour? King said, no. And when he said no, because he realized he was defeated. And the Buddha said, well, I can sit perfectly still, enjoying complete bliss, not only for an hour, not only for a day, I can sit for a whole week enjoying complete bliss. And why was that? Why could the Buddha sit still, without moving, for a whole week enjoying that bliss? Because the bliss was so absorbing. Where there was bliss, there was concentration. Where there was concentration, there was bliss. So concentration here in this context doesn't mean, as I said, forcible fixation, forcible one-pointedness of attention. It means the natural concentration which comes, which accompanies intense inner bliss. And then in dependence on that kind of concentration, there arises knowledge and vision of things as they really are. This point about bliss is very important. Bliss must be behind the concentration. You can't have the knowledge and vision of things as they really are by just an intellectual effort with just a tiny fraction of your energy. But when you experience bliss as one of these links, and when that bliss gives rise to your concentration, the whole of your energy, your total psychophysical energy is behind the thrust of your insight, your clear vision, and then you attain knowledge and vision of things as they really are, as an actual spiritual transcendental experience and not as a mere intellectual understanding. This is known as, sometimes in English, as penetrative insight, or as I've said, clear vision, and it's not anything merely theoretical or intellectual. We could perhaps call it transformative insight. With this link, the process of the permanent, irreversible transformation of the individual begins. You can't fall back into lower states of existence after you reach this point. And then, in dependence on knowledge and vision of things as they really are, there arises, the original Pali or Sanskrit word is very difficult to translate, it can be rendered as disengagement or disentanglement. You disengage from or disentangle yourself from, quite naturally, all negative, unskillful mental states and attitudes, as well as from the activities associated with such states and attitudes. One is no longer interested in such things. You don't have to give them up. They just drop off quite naturally. And then in dependence on disengagement or disentanglement that arises, 10, well, we can only translate this as passionlessness. But it's not a negative state. It's a state of positive, vibrant, transcendental equanimity. And then in dependence on passionlessness that arises, 11, liberation. A state of utter spiritual freedom. The Buddha once declared that just as the ocean has one taste, the taste of salt, so his teaching had one taste, the taste of liberation. And finally, in dependence on liberation, there arises 12, knowledge that all the mental poisons have been eradicated, have been destroyed for good. And this is tantamount to the attainment of full enlightenment.